the church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century.
O come, O come, Emmanuel.
The 16th century.
Lord, keep us steadfast in your word. Help us to fight this evil.
The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Hey, I'm a Catholic deer hunter. I am happy to be clinging to my guns and my religion.
Pro-life Democrats, you're out there. You need to go get active in your party. And really, we need to change from the ground up.
Mary is the Mother of God in December, in Advent, and Christmas. She is also the Mother of God on Epiphany, and she's the Mother of God in February. She's the Mother of God in August, too.
Preach that cross, the scandal of the cross, trusting this is the source of our salvation. And when we do, if the church gets smaller, so be it. But in the end, that is what really, truly builds the church.
Didgeridoo players in Iowa, love issues, etc.
When you walk into the church that I serve here in the Midwest, you're going to see all sorts of things. What it might seem unfamiliar to you if you've never walked into a Lutheran church before, but it's pretty common among Lutherans. You go up to the front, if you look carefully, you're going to see something. There's probably going to be, at the very least, a picture of Jesus. In the church where I serve, we have several statues of Jesus. One is superimposed over the cross, hanging very large above the altar, and there's another one, the crucifix, the corpus on the crucifix, another image of Jesus. It's not unusual if you go downstairs to see paintings or pictures of Jesus, various scenes from his life and his ministry according to the New Testament Gospels. But for, and that seems common, I think even people who don't want statues of Jesus in their church got no problem with pictures of Jesus, at least somewhere in the church building. But there was a time when this was a real question for Christians. Can you depict the person of Jesus without lapsing into idolatry, much less pictures of the saints? It's a question for the last of the seven ecumenical councils that we'll be talking about as we conclude our eight-part series on the seven ecumenical councils with Pastor Heath Curtis. Welcome back to Issues Etc., coming to you live from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Pastor Heath Curtis will be our guest for the entire hour. We will conclude our eight-part series on the seven ecumenical councils. But first, we're going to talk a little bit about Monica, who's being remembered on this day. Now, if you don't know her name, you probably know her son's name, Augustine. Why would you remember this great Saint Augustine? Why would you remember his mom? How significant was her life upon his? Now, we will be giving away the book, The Church from Age to Age, A History from Galilee to Global Christianity, to the listener with the best question or comment in this hour on the seven ecumenical councils, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-6943. Send us an email right here in the studio, talkback@issuesetc.org. Send us a tweet at @issuesetc, or leave a question or comment for Pastor Curtis at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. Pastor Heath Curtis is pastor of Trinity Lutheran Church in Warden, Illinois, and Zion Lutheran Church in Carpenter, Illinois. He's author of the book Ordering Our Days in His Peace, An Introduction to the Christian Church Year. Heath, welcome back.
Always good to be with you, Todd.
Before we get to the end of our series on the seven ecumenical councils, we're remembering as a church Monica, the mother of St. Augustine. I understand why we remember Augustine. He is a towering figure of lasting influence. Why Monica, his mom?
Well, she is really the reason why Augustine is what he is. She's a tragic figure, and yet she's a saint who triumphs over the tragedy in her life. She, as far as we know, was probably raised a Christian, or at least was a Christian before she was married. to a certain man named Patricius, and she's from North Africa, and which at the time, of course, is part of the Roman Empire. Latin is her native language. And Patricius is just kind of the prototypical jerk of a husband. He is some kind of civil functionary in the city of Tagaste, where they lived in North Africa. And he was unfaithful to his wife. He was more or less cruel to his wife and children. And through it all, Monica exuded Christian patience and charity and love for her husband and her children. And eventually, Patricius does convert to Christianity. And you might think that this will, make Monica's life better and all her sufferings will be over and so forth. But then it just rolls right into her oldest son, Augustine, who lives a life of a dissolute life, a morally repugnant life, goes off to what today we would call college, and his life becomes even worse. He fathers a son out of wedlock, and on top of all that, latches on to a heresy called Manichaeism. And so now, Monica is almost reliving all the tragedy that she's gone through in her life with her husband, who finally converted to Christianity. She's now reliving that with Augustine. Of course, Augustine wouldn't be Augustine if the story didn't have a happy ending. But once again, Monica's prayers are answered. Her patience is rewarded. Her son Augustine does come to the faith and then, of course, becomes a bishop himself in North Africa and goes on to be one of the leading theological voices in the Western Church. And we know so much about all this because Augustine is really the first writer to write what we would consider a modern biography, called a modern autobiography, I should say, called his Confessions. And in that work, he goes into a lot of detail about his upbringing, and especially his mother Monica, who was the rock that God placed in Augustine's life to make him into the great Christian leader that he would eventually become.
I want to talk about two issues that are raised there by the occasion of remembering Monica, and that is one is the real fact of what it meant, and it still does today, for a Christian, in this case Monica, to be married, at least for a time, to an unbeliever. Talk about that. I mean, Paul actually addresses that directly at some point in the New Testament, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. And Paul is stuck in a kind of a pastoral conundrum that Christian pastors still deal with today when it comes to these issues. And the first thing is, boy, it's a really bad idea for a Christian to be married to a non-Christian. Don't choose this kind of sorrow and hardship for yourself. This is what St. Paul says. The famous phrase that he puts together is that the Christian should not be unequally yoked with unbelievers. And the image there is of two oxen pulling a plow in a field. And what happens if you have two oxen who are not equally yoked, that is, one oxen is much stronger than the other, well, your plow is going to go in circles. And likewise, St. Paul says, you don't want to choose a life where you're married to a non-Christian, because this is going to cause you all kinds of hardships and heartaches. How can you have a mutual, healthy, loving relationship when you disagree on the most basic foundations of human life? Now, on the other hand, St. Paul knows that there are many Christians who either have made this unfortunate choice to marry an unbeliever, or in Paul's day especially, you would have situations where two people were married long before they heard of Christianity. One of them converts to Christianity. Well, now what do I do? So, on the other hand, St. Paul says, now, you're still a Christian if you're married to a non-Christian. Your children are not somehow cursed because one of their parents is not a Christian. He offers comfort to Christian parents in that sense. And he says, and you don't get to divorce someone because they're not a Christian. You made your bed, now lie in it. But he says, if that non-Christian leaves you, divorces you, over the faith, then you are free to remarry. You're not held captive by this non-Christian person's action of walking out of your marriage. And that this is all in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, and it's certainly worth rereading for those people who find themselves in that difficult situation.
What can, as we get to the end of this, going in this first break, what can Christian parents learn about this kind of long-suffering, prayerful vigilance that Monica seems to display, first for unbelieving husband, and then latter, her unbelieving son, who eventually does, both of whom eventually do convert? About a minute before we take our break.
Sure. Well, on the one hand, we learn from her this theology of the cross, that the Christian life, that the, because you are a Christian, you will suffer, that he who would be my disciple must take up his cross and follow me. That's certainly one thing to take from Monica, and her example of patience and grace under that cross is certainly one to be emulated. On the other hand, perhaps one danger we have when we look at the saints with happy endings, this doesn't mean that yours is going to have a happy ending. Your cross may, in this sense, be heavier than Monica's, that you will pray for this person you love so deeply, who's not a Christian, who's estranged from the church. You may walk that cross all the way to their funeral and not have the happy ending that Monica has. And so I never want folks to turn the stories of the saints into, well, if you had just been as good as Monica, this would have had a happy ending. That would be to abuse the goodness that we find in the story of the saints. She's an example to us of patience and long-suffering, but she is not a dispenser of, just follow these three steps, St. Monica's three steps to success, and everything will be hunky-dory.
When we come back with Pastor Heath Curtis, we're going to turn to the conclusion of our eight-part series on the seven ecumenical councils. We'll talk about the Second Council of Nicaea in the 8th century and images of Jesus and the saints. What are the sources and origins of writings like the Book of Mormon, the Quran, and the Gospel of Thomas, and how do they compare to the Bible? The Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for August is One Word, Many Writings, a study of the origins of religious writings. You can read an excerpt at issuesetc.org, or you can find out more about One Word, Many Writings by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. One Word, Many Writings by Dr. Adam Francisco.
If Issues Etc. refuses to scratch your itchy ears and scratches your old scabs instead, and you love them for it, then Redeemer Lutheran Church is the church in Fort Wayne for you. The only real difference between Issues Etc. and Redeemer is that Todd and Jeff only talk about Jesus. We talk about Jesus, but we also put him into people's mouths. We drive off demons with water. We are the church, and yes, we serve Jell-O in the basement.
Continuing education for the Confessional Lutheran. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Here are two new ways to stay connected to Issues Etc., Facebook and Twitter. You'll find photos of in-studio guests at facebook.com/issuesetc, and you'll find a list of upcoming topics and guests on Twitter at issuesetc. Social networking for the thinking Christian, facebook.com/issuesetc, and on Twitter at issuesetc. Connect with fellow Issues Etc. junkies today, facebook.com/issuesetc, and on Twitter at issuesetc.
Well, Justin has completed his summer work at Sylvan Learning Center in Edwardsville. His reading comprehension has improved more than 3 grade levels, and his vocabulary has increased almost an entire grade level. Sylvan Learning Center of Edwardsville has a 6-week back-to-school boot camp. Their phone number, 618-656-0500, 618-656-0500. Emily has 4 weeks left at Sylvan. A report on her progress next time.